Good afternoon. The House Committee on Rules come to order. It's Monday, May 13, 2013. We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3309, and we'll start our testimony with Speaker Kotek and Representative Freeman.
Good afternoon.
If you'd like, we can have staff introduce the bill so we know what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3309 comes to you from your House Health Care Committee without recommendation. The measure authorizes Board of Directors of Coordinator Care Organization to petition Director of Oregon Health Authority to remove board member by vote of 2/3 of membership under specified conditions. It requires reduction in reimbursement paid for services provided by health care entity represented by removed board member. Requires OHA to decertify the CCO that fails to meet qualification criteria and requirements, fails to ensure member safeguards, or fails to reduce reimbursement paid to healthcare entity represented by removed board member. This measure has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Nice to see you today. I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, and Speaker of the House. With the good Representative Freeman here today talking about House Bill 3309. For better or for worse, we feel kind of like the grandparents or godparents of healthcare transformation, so we like to weigh in when we think there's an issue of importance. So, you know, the bill before you today is an attempt to recognize the fact that it's important for the coordinated care organizations within the healthcare transformation to work. And sometimes you have to make available other mechanisms to make sure that happens. When we put the framework for the CCOs together here in Oregon, you know, we realized it was going to be incredibly complex and that it wouldn't be possible for us to write a bill that would cover all things and would cover all instances. We tried to write as broadly as possible so we could move forward with the conversation, but invariably things will pop up. House Bill 3309 attempts to address one of those unforeseen issues. And you know, when we designed the framework for CCOs, our focus was on attracting the right folks who want to come to the table and create a coordinated care organization in their community. And we hope that by having the right members at the table, the collaboration could happen and that we will continue to reduce the cost of health care for folks on the Oregon Health Plan. But, you know, we can't account for all the scenarios that have surfaced, and, you know, there's been some issues with some CCOs around how boards that have been created are communicating and working together. And we want to make sure that these coordinated care organizations are successful. And I think what you see in 3309, and if this isn't quite right in terms of how it's written, the point is, do we need to consider a mechanism when there is dysfunction within a coordinated care organization to give the state some kind of tool to jump in when it seems necessary to put everything back on track? And that's the attempt in this bill. You know, most CCOs are not having any issues. There's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of coordination. But this is tough work. We're asking people to change their business models. And not everybody is as enthused about it as others. And so what you see in 3309 is a way to address, you know, situations that will arise with regards of disagreement among boards when it seems necessary. Perhaps the triggers aren't quite right. Maybe the way it's written isn't totally right. But the intent, I think, is something that we need to address here because we have to be stewards of the money and hold these organizations accountable. So I urge you to continue to work on this bill and give it due consideration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Garrett and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman, State Representative for House District 2, also one of those godfathers of healthcare transformation. It is a pleasure to be here today with my good friend Speaker Kotek on all things healthcare transformation. However, we are not here to talk about anything to do with the statute. That will come later. So, get too excited behind us. So, as Speaker Kotek described, we worked really hard on House Bill 3650 and 1580, recognizing that there was going to be things that come up that we would not think of. As you all know, when you do legislation, thinking of every single scenario into the future is virtually impossible, and oftentimes legislation gets stalled because of the what-ifs. We agreed early on that we wanted to move forward with doing the best legislation we could at the time with the information we had. And we focused a lot of our efforts on how do we get people in the room together? How do we force them to come together and work together? And that really was the main focus. And I think the legislation that we have that does that, including the arbitration, works very well for getting people around a table. So the one thing we really didn't think of, and maybe because we were thinking in such a positive way and working so hard to get people in the room together, we didn't think about what would happen if you had a destructive member on the board or somebody that wasn't working for the best intent of the entire CCO. And we really didn't do anything and put anything in place that would be a disincentive that would discourage that such behavior. The other thing we didn't think about, there's nothing stopping a rogue member from joining a CCO and then competing against the one they just left. So those two things we really hadn't thought about. So this bill means to address those two specific things we hadn't thought of. And I know there was a term earlier used that was sort of derogatory towards actors, and we're not going to use that term. I understand one of the actors in the building didn't care for it. So I'd like to maybe create a new term, maybe think of this more in a way of a divorce. When you got people in a room, they've got assets, they're working together, and then it becomes where they can no longer do it. So really this is what this legislation seeks to do, and it really seeks to have an off-ramp for folks when they're not working well together. But I think probably more importantly what it does is because that off-ramp is there, or that ability for a divorce, that comes with some pretty strong penalties for not working together, really encourages people to get back around the table and work together. Back to what the original intent of the bills were. It was to have people work together for a common solution to work for the good. And my belief, if this bill is to pass, it would more than likely create a situation where you would get the people that aren't working very well together in our state back at the table working together, because the alternative of leaving would be detrimental. And that's really the you know, we talk about carrot and stick. In this situation, this is the stick. We're talking about if you all can't figure out how to work together and you're in there just causing problems and you need to be asked to leave, it's going to cost you to do it. And hopefully, and it is our intent, and certainly my intent, that doesn't happen. I want people to work together in a community to find the solution for innovation and delivering health care. So it really is unfortunate that we have to talk about it, but we do have to talk about it because it is occurring, and you're all aware of the situation where it's occurring. And if it can occur in one part of our state, clearly the way the law is written, it can occur in other parts of the state, and we probably need to head that off before it happens. So the bill is still crafted to maintain as much local control as possible. That was a fundamental piece of the legislation that passed. And it does not affect any of the CCOs as long as the members of the board are trying to get along and trying to work for the greater good of the entire CCO and trying not to be destructive. And really the bill will help communities thrive because it does discourage folks from using the current law to get involved to do bad things. And again, I don't know that that's happening, but we didn't think about that when we drafted the original law. This bill will fix those things, and I would definitely encourage you all to figure out a way. If there's some wording changes that needs to be done, like Speaker Kotek said, there is a problem here and we do need to try to fix it. So thank you.
Thank you both. Any questions for the panel? I see none. Thank you both
thank
for your testimony
and
for getting us started. Senator Winters and Representative Clem and Representative Cameron. Whoever'd like to begin.
Senator, of course.
I've learned.
Thank you, Chair Garrett and members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Senator Jackie Winters, and I represent District 10, which includes Salem, Almsville, Turner, Monmouth, and Independence. I'm here in support of this bill that's got a tag around this building, and I want to talk a little bit about when we do comprehensive House Bill 3309. I've been around, as most of you know, a long time, and when you undertake a transforming any major kind of programs and events like we did with the healthcare reform, Never can that happen without there's going to be some glitches along the way or some changes that you have to come back to this body in order to make certain that you've added another I or dotted another T or crossed. And that's no different when we're here today and talking about House Bill 3309. This bill is an attempt to ensure that all the major healthcare systems are working together in a collaborative manner inside of one CCO. And, you know, when you look at the structure of how we put together the CCOs, we're saying that providers and those who are involved in the healthcare delivery system shall work together in a collaborative way. No longer will we have all these silos that exist and all this independence that exists today, because we're going to become a more healthier community by all working together. And I'm going to speak for my county because that's what I know probably the best. And traditionally in Marion and Polk counties, we have, and I constantly go around this building with bragging rights of saying that in Marion County that we come together when there's an issue or a problem, and we work together, whether it was getting together to bring all the agencies and the nonprofits and everyone together to work on the meth issue in this community or whatever those issues may be. Unfortunately, I think when we went down this path on trying to get everyone together on this particular issue with healthcare, this healthcare reform, we ran into some glitches and problems. I attempted to do it on the mediator side as the leader of this community and said, okay, let's sit down and work together and see if we can't come to some kind of working together collaboratively like we've done with other things. That did not happen. And sometime as, you know, the godfather and the godmother who gave birth to this whole transformation stated, there's some times when you have to step in and say, well, maybe we need to be able to say, okay, we need some, you want to call it stick or carrot, but we've got to get everyone playing together so that for the betterment of the community. Healthcare reform and what we did here last session was a tremendous undertaking. And it was an undertaking that says we're going to bring everyone together to work for the benefit of our the citizenry in this state, because we want to be a healthier society. Not only that, we want to control that cost curve. And so if we don't have everyone playing together together on the same page, if for whatever reason one or two of them decide, I don't want to play, what we put together then begins to collapse. And the objectives that we started out with in this building doesn't go forward. This bill is actually an attempt to make certain that it does go forward, because we say now it's Salem or it's someplace else, but if we get one in one place, it can happen in other places. So I think we need the sideboard, quite honestly, and that's not unusual in what we do in this building, to enact legislation to make certain that the outcomes are what we intended for them to be. And I'm certain everybody will not be happy, because there's always some who are not happy with the regulations that we apply in this building. But I also know that for the good of all, that we have to find a way that everyone is sitting at the table working for the good of all, and that what we started here to do healthcare reform goes forward. I see it, the problem, we'll also be back next session with a little more tinkering of something, because we'll find some other thing, the balloon that came off someplace. But for now, I support House Bill 3309 and the mission that it's trying to accomplish, and that is to encourage everyone to play nice in the sandbox.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, state representative from here in Salem District 21. And Salem Hospital is now, after post-redistricting, resides in my district. It's the largest private employer in my district. First, let me start by thanking Representative Cameron for co-sponsoring this bill with me. This is not a partisan issue we are trying to address. It is an attempt to make healthcare transformation successful in our community and help ensure that other communities are successful as well. There's been some various analysis of how the bill exactly structured and how it would work, so I wanted to at least walk through the way the bill works for the record. So 3309 allows a CCO to petition the Oregon Health Authority to remove a board member with a two-thirds vote of the CCO's governing board upon request of the CCO's governing board. Once petitioned, the OHA would use an established dispute resolution process to determine if the board member should be removed. Hopefully, this dispute resolution process would get all the parties working together inside the CCO governance process. If it doesn't and removal is approved, the measure reduces the board member's Medicare reimbursement rate to 58% and, more importantly, prevents the board member from contracting with any CCO for 5 years. The five-year ban is similar to the Medicare Advantage insurance statutes and is designed to ensure that a destructive board member does not take financial or programming information from one CCO to another or to create a new CCO. These penalties are intended to discourage groups or businesses who may intentionally act against the best interest of the CCO that they had chosen to join for financial gain. Our community-based CCO will be a vital part of the healthcare delivery system for years to come in this community. The attempt of this bill is to ensure that the whole healthcare system is working together to make the necessary changes, not to just benefit the system inherently as it was prior to healthcare transformation. And I guess that's the core bottom line. It feels like we've got some parties still stuck in the old fee-for-service, the old paradigm. And to be honest, I was shocked when I read the news that everybody got gotten together and formed a CCO. I couldn't believe that all these parties who I had known, like anybody from Salem here in public policy had known, have had lots of problems with each other over the years on a variety of different issues. And I read in the paper the formation of a new CCO and everybody was in it, and I couldn't believe it. And I was not then that surprised when within a few months I saw that they were in a lawsuit against each other. So I was worried about how that would get resolved. I knew that more august community leaders than myself wanted to do something pleasant and nice, and let's call everybody together and talk. And I went to that meeting and said, I really hope this works. This looks great. If it doesn't, the legislature is going to have to do something, because this we cannot allow our problem to drag down healthcare transformation, which isn't just an Oregon issue. We've received billions of dollars from the federal government to make this work. And I didn't want our community being the linchpin that gets pulled out and all of a sudden the whole thing begins to tumble. So I'm not in a position where I'm uncomfortable with awkward, blunt situations. That's fine with me, but for most people who like to get along with others, this has been terrible. And the hope is we can find some tool for a neutral third party like the OHA to come in and say, yeah, this really is a problem, and we can't waste millions of taxpayer money on lawsuits when this could be resolved in another manner. And I would encourage you supporting us all in that effort to try and force this conversation.
And Mr. Chair, I apologize. I need to go to preside over my committee.
Thanks for being here. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here before you. For the record, State Representative Kevin Cameron, representing South Salem, Almsville, Turner, and East Rural Salem. I want to share with you my colleague here. Obviously, we've sponsored this bill together. Made a comment about being blunt. I guess I'm one of those on the opposite side. Maybe I'm not as blunt. I'd like to see people come to the table and get together. And if you really understand what this bill does, it just simply provides another avenue, another tool in the toolbox for the CCO board to consider, to get people to come to the table and work together. And I think this body knows what that feels like at times and also knows what it doesn't feel like at times. As a business person, I also understand that you've got to set up a model that makes dollars, or you'll be out of business. And so it's a tough, difficult thing for us to transform healthcare. I don't know if the CCOs are the total answer. It's still too early to tell. But we've got to get them to the table and get our best attempt to work. And when I think of it as a business person, I think of, if I am being rewarded based on widgets that are coming into my facility, i.e. whether that's the doctor's office or the hospital, and the whole goal of the CCO is to reduce the number of widgets that are coming into my facility, we have a challenge on our hands.
to figure out how you're going to have an
incentive to make money and reduce the number of widgets that we're going to see. I'll be clear, these are human beings. They're not widgets. And it's important that we take care of those people in the right way. And I think that if you look at this bill, it's simply another tool in the toolbox to help the CCOs work together in the community, which we are famous for here in Marion County. And so I would encourage your support of this bill today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Embro.
I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very sympathetic to what you're both trying to do with this bill. And I think everyone hopes that were the bill to pass, it would never have to be used. But if it were used, what would be the effect in a community like Salem if, say, the Salem Hospital were not part of a CCO? What options would Oregon Health Authority, you know, low-income patients have, you know, for getting their care?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned, there's two real effects right now. One is the Salem Health, or so the Salem Hospital, wouldn't be able to join another one, so they could be a vendor to a CCO only, and that would be at a much lower rate than they currently would enjoy. So they would, I'm sure, be affected by taking patients in that population covered under the CCO at, you know, a 10% lower rate than they want, and even a 6% lower rate than what's being offered by the CCO. So it's not somewhere in between where the parties are at now. It's below that to say, you know, make a deal here, please. And it would have real effects on the hospital's, you know, financial, I don't know about stability overall, but certainly when they serve that population, it would be a significant decrease in the reimbursement that they receive for that covered population.
I'm not the healthcare expert in the room, obviously. I flip hamburgers for a living, but I would think that if somebody had an emergency, Salem Hospital would have to see them. This population would have to be seen, and the reimbursement would be lower. If we're talking about specifically here in this community, but there's other communities that could be potentially impacted by this particular bill. There are other hospitals in the area. If it was a non-emergency, maybe one of those players would be contracted to see those non-emergency type cases. But I'm not the expert. You'll have to ask some, you know, maybe get some other opinions on that.
Yeah, I don't know that these guys are the right ones to answer, but I would like to know, is this directed at the situation with Salem Hospital? Are they in or under the provisions of this bill, the current CCO? Does this apply to the situation at Salem Hospital directly?
Here's what else.
Because, Mr. Chair, I understand that there is a court case pending, and I'm not sure that we can slip in here at this, and what exactly is the, if this is all directed at a single hospital in a single situation, I would like that on the record.
Chair Garrett and Representative Berger, here's what I'll say. There's no mention of any entity other than CCO in this particular bill.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just a little concerned about the how big the stick is with the 58%. It seems like that's, you know, potentially a pretty big issue that could inhibit other, I guess, organizations that may want to be on a board to think, gee, why do we jeopardize having our reimbursement cut down to 58%? Do you think there's another mechanism for a stick? I mean, just being removed from the board, I guess, is a stick in a way, but it seems like that is a pretty severe stick for some organization that may want to disagree and get sanctioned by a two-thirds of the CCO and then, you know, have a 6% reduction in their reimbursement. I mean, I think that has some real economic implications to any member of a board like that.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I just want to make sure everybody knows it's not 58% of 100%. Currently, hospitals in this category would enjoy about a 68% reimbursement, and this would, in many CCOs, there's been agreements to have them reimbursed at 64%, and then other kinds of bonuses, depending on keeping people healthy, it could creep back up. And so this is down at 58% versus more around, say, 64%, somewhere between 64 and 68%. Are there other methods? I think there probably are. For example, if at least in our community, there was an agreement to drop the lawsuits and go with some sort of binding arbitration process, you know, that would at least make me happy and satisfy me that you don't that was the kind of stick that was needed. But to get to that place where someone would agree to do something like that, you sort of have to hit them in the pocketbook. There's no other real way to hit somebody in this arena except in the pocketbook. So it's got to be significant enough that two-thirds of the governing board petition and the Oregon Health Authority, who's trying to make this whole thing work, who isn't going to just act capriciously to just start penalizing people, they would have to believe that it was harming the overall healthcare transformation effort so significantly that they would want to apply that kind of financial penalty to one person, knowing that could cause other problems in the healthcare system if it really put their fiscal solvency on the line or something. You know, unlikely that the OHA would want to go there and would instead, you know, push them into some sort of dispute resolution process the bill calls for with a different hammer, you know, or a different way to solve the problem.
Chair Garrett and Representative Hovind, I would say that the ultimate other option is at the table originally, outside of this, outside of the courts, the people that have very, very important at stake in our community to make sure, or any community to make sure, that this population is taken care of within the best of our ability.
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. I was sitting here reflecting about this conflict and reminded me early in my psychologist training, one of my professors said, you'll do a better job if you remember all people are basically incompatible.
Incompatible.
And I think what that says is that we get along because we work at it and probably because we have some good rules. And I'm hoping, you know, as the speaker suggested, we need some suggestions here. I see we have quite a list of people coming up to talk. I hope people will focus on some suggestions of how to make this better. I think your approach is appropriate but inelegant, if I may. And I'm hoping maybe we can find a little bit better way to bring people together and get them to solve their differences. And so that's my comment.
Usually I'm referred to as inappropriate and inelegant, so I will take that as
that's a compliment. Yes, thank you.
Let somebody
see, we're getting along already.
Oh, yeah, someone is classing up the dais. You know, I will say that there was an operating agreement, at least in our case here. There was an operating agreement with an LLC that was formed. In there was a dispute resolution method. That didn't get used. Instead, the courts were used. We've already passed a bill this session to create dispute resolution methods beyond just the one for joining the CCO or making the CCO, the creation of the CCO in the first place. So we are already figuring out there needs to be dispute resolution methods beyond just when they're formed. And I think those kind of solutions are helpful, but we're pretty much already making progress this session on this. We just, in some cases, whether it's the one in our community or somewhere else, occasionally there will be a really destructive practice that threatens the entire stability, and that's when the health authority needs to be able to, at the request of the remaining people, to essentially vote somebody off the island. And that's the bottom line here.
All right, thank you. I think we're ready to move to our... Thank you both for being here. Representative Parrish is here on a different bill. We're going to temporarily close the public hearing on 3309 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3510. Representative Parrish, and then we'll go back to 3309.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3510 prohibits a person that is not authorized reseller from selling admission ticket to entertainment event if operator or entertainment event has not released admission tickets for sale, requires person that is not authorized reseller to have, at time at which person sells admission tickets, demonstrable immediate access to current printed or electronic inventory that is updated with each admission ticket sale to show exact number and location of spaces at venue that remain unsold, and physical inventory of printed tickets if operator requires authorized reseller to have physical inventory of printed tickets. Requires person that is not authorized reseller to make certain disclosures and advertisements and communication that solicits purchase of admission tickets.
Well, thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Julie Parrish, House District 37, and my co-sponsor on this bill, Representative Williamson, who kindly offered up a priority bill to do this bill with me, is in another committee, could not be here to testify. So a few months, well, that month or so, right after we got into session, I got an email from a constituent who had gone online to buy War Horse tickets from Keller Auditorium, bought from a site that she thought was Keller Auditorium, that was representing itself as Keller Auditorium, and wound up paying almost double the face value of the tickets that she was going to buy. So she came, got a hold of me and said, you know, well, what can you do? And I said, well, you know, the fact of it is the internet and in the online world is really an interstate commerce issue. There's not a lot that we can do, but I'll reach out to the folks at Keller Auditorium and we'll have a conversation. So I got a hold of the gal there who manages not only Keller, but the other venues in the Portland, so your Children's Theater and some of the other venues downtown, and they're all in Jennifer Williamson's district. And so she said she'd love to come talk to me, and we formed a little group. I sent out an email to all legislators, and I said, if you want to come and meet, I'd be happy to have you join us in the conversation. Representative Williamson sent her staff, and we sat down, and we kind of walked through the process of going online, buying a ticket, and what you come up with as a result of that. And so I gave you guys little packets to kind of peek through here, and you do have the kind of testimony from Kathy Walter, who is my constituent, about her experience buying from a company called Goody Tickets, thinking she was at an authorized reseller of Keller Auditorium. So I went through and highlighted for you a concert that my children would like to go to this summer. It is sold out at the Edgefield, but I could go to Goody Tickets online and certainly purchase them there as she did. I've highlighted for you in red their piece of kind of where they're saying that they're not an authorized reseller. And if you look at specifically at the bottom circle, you can barely read that they don't have any kind of contractual relationship with Edgefield at all. So if you look at the next page of the color prints here, you'll notice that the tickets, if I wanted to buy two of them, are $735 for this concert, to buy two tickets there. If you notice in their kind of delivery options, it says, if the exact tickets I've chosen are unavailable, I will accept equal or better tickets if they're available at the same price. And you'll also notice on the first page, they've done kind of a venue map. They've taken and lifted the venue map from the Edgefield and put it on there like they're, again, trying to purport that they're an authorized reseller. If you flip to the back page, look at the Kink website, radio station's website, and at the very bottom, you'll notice that the tickets for this concert were $39.50, not $760. And if I wanted to buy them the day of the show, $43 plus a dollar for charity would have been the admission price. And it's all general admission seating, so there wasn't anywhere else that you could go and do this. So we sat and we kind of worked through this process, and as we were sitting there in this little work group, we went online and looked at Rose Garden and Keller Auditorium. So if you look at the next little page I've given you, this is kind of the Google first page of a Google search. And so when you look at Rose Garden, you've got rose.gardenportland.com, purporting to be the Rose Garden, rosegarden.boxofficeticketsales.com, rosegarden.ticketnetwork.com. Then you get three sites that are really the Rose Garden. Then you kind of go into the Ticketmaster and StubHub and Ticket City, and then you're back down to rosegardenarenatickets.net. The hand note on the side that I've written, obviously the ones that are, and when I say fake, it's fake because they're selling speculative inventory. They actually don't even have a ticket to sell you. But if you go to the side, if you're looking at it on your right-hand side, Rose Garden Tickets, on the side ads, ticketliquidator.com. I just got off the phone with the vice president of the Rose Garden Arena, and also manages the Trailblazers, and he said the Michael Bublé concert, if you go to click on this and open it up, you'll find the seating map for the Rose Garden. You can buy the ticket right now for $110 to $1,050 for that concert ticket. The concert's November 16th. The kick here is that the Rose Garden hasn't even confirmed with the talent that this concert is going to happen. But you can go right now and buy a ticket online and maybe get something should the concert actually come into play. So that's kind of problematic. The same is true when you look at the Keller Auditorium on the back page. Again, this is kind of the situation that my constituent found herself in. You've got keller.auditoriumportland, portland.broadway.com, vividseats/kellerauditorium, and the list kind of goes on and on. And then I've also included for you from the Goody Ticket people their terms of service, which are 7 pages deep about how you can and can't get the ticket and what your options are for a ticket. And so this kind of speculative marketplace is, particularly for the Keller Auditorium, if you go to that keller.auditoriumportland.com right now, you can go and buy a ticket for Chicago in September. Keller hasn't even released the tickets. So if you're just kind of Joe and Jane citizen buying tickets for an event, you are definitely, you go to one of these sites, you're definitely not getting what you're paying for. So this bill is designed to try to get at that. Now, the interesting thing about this bill is it really doesn't mention the Internet. As somebody who has made a living online for, more than a half dozen years, I feel like I pretty much understand the ecosystem of the Internet, and my goal is not to regulate the Internet. My goal is to try to pass a piece of legislation that swims kind of in the self-policing model of the Internet. So what we've done is we've said that a ticket, in this case, that you would actually have to, you couldn't do speculative sales. You couldn't actually sell something you don't have. We would consider that a counterfeit ticket. And that if you are not an authorized reseller, you don't have a relationship as a ticket reseller with the venue or the talent, that you could still sell a ticket, but you'd have to make sure people really know very clearly you're not an authorized reseller, because we want people to, you know, be able to go through it and get something that is truly a ticket. The way we put this together, the goal here is in talking with the venues, and several of us have venues in our districts across the state, but the goal really is that if we have strong enough language about what ticket sales really are and aren't, that rather than try to set up a situation where we want a consumer to have to go sue some guy in Texas who's in his basement selling fake tickets and go through that process, we want Keller Auditorium or the Rose Garden to be able to contact the search engines and, using their own terms of service, actually be able to say, Oregon statute says this is a counterfeit ticket, this is a trademark issue, be able to go through and have the Internet search engine look at that, look at the law in Oregon and say, yeah, AdWords client, you can't do that here, and start to, you know, kind of weed them out of the system. So I'm not in a position where I want to regulate the Internet or where I want to tax it or do any of those kind of things, but I think that we can create, as we're looking at how do we deal with Internet issues, and this is certainly probably not something Congress is going to take up as far as a federal interstate trade issue, how do we as state legislators then actually create statutes that allow a consumer or somebody who is being ripped off in that kind of bottom feeder piece of the Internet ecosphere, how do we give tools out there so that they can work within the systems that Google and Bing and Yahoo and Facebook and others have created in terms of what their Internet terms of service look like. Now, interestingly, talking to Representative Williamson, she said that when she started her own kind of campaign site and wanted to do some stuff with Google, Google wouldn't let her go because she didn't have her privacy policy in the right place. I mean, that's how technical some of these search engines and things are. They really want you to be above board. And we're saying as a state that these tickets are not above board by redefining them this way. They're not above board, and we want to be able to have a mechanism for a search engine to be able to pull these AdWords or side ad type ads off of their website. So a couple things about the bill. You are going to hear probably some testimony that this might hurt some of the second tier markets. You might hear some testimony that, this is about a monopoly for any of the big dog Ticketmaster type. You know, it's really not. You'll also hear that excluded from this arrangement are consumers, that consumers can't sell under this law. Well, we worked really hard to make sure consumers still could sell, because what we don't want to do is kind of hurt the fan-to-fan market. I bought one too many tickets, or my husband's sick, and we want to be able to sell that on Craigslist or through a StubHub or somebody who is doing the peer-to-peer sales. We don't want those folks to be excluded. So if you look at the first page of the bill, it says a reseller other than an authorized reseller, and earlier in the bill, we define what that authorized reseller is. They may not sell the admission ticket that an operator has not released for sale. So that's not a fan-to-fan issue, because somebody who's already, as a fan, who's selling on Craigslist or somewhere else for a ticket, already probably has the ticket or pretty close to being able to have that e-ticket type relationship. That they, if at the time that they're selling the ticket, that they have to be able to actually demonstrate, you know, you're going to get row X and, you know, seat number 9 and in this section of a stadium. And if I have tickets that I've bought from Cirque du Soleil or whatever, I've actually got those tickets in hand as an e-ticket, and I know where I'm sitting because I chose those tickets as I was buying them. Now, there are some venues who will say that this is the section that you can buy in, and if that's all you can, if that's as much information as you have from the actual venue as here's the section, you're in section G or you're section general admission, then we believe that that's okay under this bill. If we need to tighten that language, we're willing to do that. There's also a couple other little technical things in here that we're going to come back with an amendment and get at. But at the end of the day, I don't think any of us want our constituents paying $735 for what should have been $70 of tickets to go out to the Edgefield and take your kids out to a concert in the summer. This, all of our venues are dealing with this. So you can look at the Shakespeare Festival. You can look at, you know, Oxon Stadium. You can look at all of these venues, whether it's sports or arts or theater, and they're all dealing with this. Now, Tennessee tried to have a bill this session trying to get at it, and they tried to get at it a different way, more of a control the internet. And again, I don't think we can do that. I think we have to give people tools to kind of work in the, you know, the internet kind of has ways to self-police, and that bill died. Some of the second market sellers came out and found a way to get that bill killed. So the interesting thing is that the whole nation's kind of watching this bill. We've heard from the folks on Broadway. We've heard from the international venue folks. We've heard from people all across the country going, if Oregon solves this and doesn't do it by, you know, trying to tackle the internet, but rather defining what those tickets are and then trying to work with the ebb and flow of the internet, they think that this would be model policy that could go across the country, and the guy in his basement in Texas in his underwear selling tickets, you know, that he doesn't even have, that guy, that's not a legitimate business, and we don't want him doing business with people in Oregon. So that's what the bill is. That's what the attempt is. We are willing to certainly work with some of the folks who might have some second-tier issues on this to try to get it right, but we really do want to get this bill right this section. It's a good bipartisan bill, and I think all of our constituents would thank us for solving this for them.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll note that I've received, I think, 80 emails over the weekend on this bill. I think that's the right number. Almost all of them criticize the bill on the grounds that if I buy an extra ticket that I don't need, I can't sell it. I think, as I look at the top, bottom of page one and the top of page two, that isn't true.
That's not true.
And I think that's what you've just told us, too, that in fact, a consumer who has an extra ticket or can't go that night meets all these requirements. I got tickets in my hand. I've got row C, seats 4 and 6, 4 and 5. I should be able to sell them. I have them in my hand. This bill doesn't prevent that.
We don't believe it does. And again, we're willing to kind of clarify any language if people really do think that. But we think that first page, that, you know, that you can't have it if you actually haven't released the ticket. Again, this is, Keller hasn't actually released Chicago tickets in September, so you can't sell something you don't have or you don't have access to. And that the other piece of this is that you can demonstrate that you have immediate access. You can either, if I'm going on Craigslist and we're going to meet at Safeway, you know, in the parking lot and meet up and or sell you the ticket at Starbucks and we're going to meet, I have access. I've got a ticket I'm going to sell you. Or if it came to you in an email and the terms of service from whoever the provider is doesn't say you can't transfer it via an email, then you could send it to me via email and I, you know, PayPal you some money. You could do that as well under this bill. We believe that you can do that under this bill. If we need to clarify that, we're absolutely willing to clarify that. But our goal is not, and our intention is to not remove that fan-to-fan piece and have you eat a ticket that you can't actually get to an event, you get a sick kid or whatever. So
follow up, and then we need to get back to our...
Yeah, thank you. And just very quickly, the enforcement on this, it looks to me like it's the end of Section 1. It's an unlawful trade practice. And an action. Is that going to be sufficient to allow the people who are concerned about this stuff to shut these guys down?
So, I mean, that we had the Department of Justice sat in on those conversations with us, and, you know, we kind of got the sense that we felt that that was kind of standard language. So what we're really hoping, though, is that Keller can go to the search engines specifically and say, this is not a real ticket in Oregon. We wouldn't consider this guy who's selling the Michael Bublé tickets for $1,000 and the Rose Garden hasn't even authorized the concert yet, that that's a real ticket. You can't sell something like that under this bill. And so we would hope that they could start to, you know, learn how to, and I'm happy to show them how to kind of work through that that ecosystem of the internet to do the self-policing. But this also would allow, if you have somebody who's really egregious, it really would let the Department of Justice get in and have a conversation with those folks as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative. Oh, Representative Holley, do you have a question?
No.
Thank you. We have, we'll come back to this later in the afternoon. We have a few more witnesses. But for now, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3510. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3309, and I'd like to ask Dr. Pierce, Dr. Leonard, and Mr. Hetherington to come up.
Chair Garrett and Vice Chair Hoyle and committee members, I'm Bud Pierce, MD, and I'm here today testifying as a private citizen. I have a handout that has hopefully been given to you. I'll just make a few comments. There's a lot of people in the audience who obviously want to speak on this topic. I'm passionate on this topic because of my roots, where I came from. My dad was a janitor. He died when I was 14. I started bagging groceries for tips when I was 16 and spent most of my college years on the weekends and the summers working as an orderly in a nursing home for minimum wage. And the community that the Oregon Health Plan and CCOs are to serve are the community that I came from. They're my roots, and I haven't forgotten them. It's imperative for the CCO structure to work, to provide excellent health care for the poor and the working poor. The New England Journal of Medicine recently reported that the Oregon citizens who were randomized to the health plan did not have improved health care outcomes. They had less anxiety, they had better diagnoses, but their health care outcomes were not better. What that really says is that in order to be healthier, the poor need good jobs that pay them, and they need a different kind of health care delivery system, not the traditional health care delivery system that we have created. The CCO attempts to do this. It requires hospitals and doctors to cede power to the CCO, which includes a lot of community representatives, and we need to develop innovative programs in that structure to make people more well, not simply to treat the many diseases that these individuals have. And we need to have programs of prevention. So in many communities, we have monopolistic hospital or physician groups that, if they do not want to participate, can clearly disrupt the process of program formation by the CCOs. We need to have a mechanism, a firm regulatory mechanism when monopolies exist. HB 3309 is a way to accomplish that, and I urge your support.
Thank you.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Dan Leonard, and I am a practicing surgeon here in town. I've been here for 20 years now. I'm also the president of the Willamette Valley Physicians Health Authority. So I'm here really talking about from a physician standpoint. I'm in support of Bill 3309. What I like to say is we're kind of at the epicenter of this process right now in terms of we're kind of in a snag. I'll call our group the IPA, Independent Physician Association, because that represents everybody in our area here. We've been a fairly innovative group. When Governor Dr. Kitzhaber came to us and had us help with the Oregon Health Plan, we were able to do that. And because of having some capitation-type style of payment, it gave us the luxury to be creative and innovative. And through that, we've had several very interesting programs with this population of patients, the MOMS program, so forth, which you can't do it with fee-for-service medicine. So it has allowed us to do that, and so we have. In the CCO, so we've gone now statewide, not just in our area, we're pretty excited about it. And as a state, I mean, I think, you know, if you don't know, Oregon's very cutting edge in its medical care. And this is really cutting edge. What we're trying to do is on the forefront, and I don't mind to get, you know, be a cheerleader for it, but it's really exciting because it's the very grassroots effort that most people in healthcare believe, whether you're any of the innovators believe that the traditional fee-for-service style of medicine, it will always have a cost curve, whether you have an HMO that bends it for a little bit, it's going to have a fee, it's going to, cost curve is going to go like this. So what the CCO does, and it's starting with this very difficult population of patients, is saying, how can we go about changing this? And so one of the ways is to be creative in not only how we take care of the patients, but also how we pay the providers. And I say that because originally we just rolled all contracts over and hoping that everybody would just kind of say, okay, let's get our feet wet and then let's get going on being creative. And then we hit this snag in our area. To address Dr. Holvey that, and or excuse me, not Dr. Holvey, Representative Holvey, sorry. Kennenmeyer. Yeah.
Anyway, you're all in trouble.
You can tell I'm out of my element. But I liken healthcare transformation to the American automobile industry in the 1970s. Okay, a very stock standard of business had happened, and it wasn't until the Japanese came and said, "Wow, we can build cars differently." And as a result of that, it shook them up. And the only thing that shook up the American automobile industry was the fact that their market share finally took a chunk where they said, we have to reinvent ourselves. So in answer to your question, I think we're talking about healthcare transformation. We're talking about a style of medicine between all providers that's been around for 50 years. It is embedded in our culture. And we are going to have a big stick if we are going to have people take baby steps into the future. But as a result of that, I think it's really important, and we're very cutting edge. I think we can be a model for the rest of the nation. And the other thing I would like to address, it was actually Representative Holvey on this one, is that also, if it's going to happen in our area, it's just that we kind of missed out when we wrote the healthcare transformation. It's just we didn't get an off-ramp. We didn't provide this really motivator to help people arbitrate and discuss. Right now, they have a really path off. They have an easy path completely off and can derail. And so what this does is it really says, no, to be creative and to do this, we all have to work together. And we need our hospital in the organization as a partner and wanting to do it, because it's only through this partnership creating or generating creative ways to change our current system that I think we're going to move forward. So with that, I think that it's the people who will say, well, it's just a local problem. It's going to be a statewide problem. There will always be someone else. So this just addresses that. And two, do you need this big of a stick? And I think yes, because what's happening now is it's the medical, it's just like the automobile industry of the 1970s. We are in that right now. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Hetherington.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care, and we are a CCO operating in the Portland area. I was asked to come down and speak in favor of 3309, and as I sat down and read it for the first time last week, I said, well, I'm not really in favor of the language of the bill, so to satisfy my own OCD compulsions, I rewrote good part of section two. There's a couple things that I found problematic. Number one, I think most boards can handle their own business in terms of expelling members if there's a problem with a member, and I think that's the board's business, not the state's. And then I found the rest of it, I would say, somewhat inelegant in the way it would try to do the approach. So I'd like to go through the amendments that I handed out in front of you to see if this does probably address it a little bit more clearly and specifies what is and is not appropriate. I addressed the entities as essential healthcare entities. So we're not talking about just a hospital, but anybody who is a sole provider of services in a community, who provides or controls healthcare services of more than 25% so they would have to be a substantial provider, or whose withdrawal or act or refusal to act puts an organization at risk of decertification. So that'll bring in, I would think, most of the people who could, quote, be called a problematic actor in this arena. And then number two, I tried to define the issues that I think would arise and have arisen, particularly in Salem, and frankly, not only this year, but some of the issues I've seen in 28 years of running a managed care organization for the Medicaid problem that we've seen over the years, most recently was 2003. So number one would be refusing to deliver services to any person covered under a managed health care contract. So they couldn't do that. They could not refuse to contract or refuse to cooperate. So if they say they don't want a contract, that's fine. But as a non-contracted provider, they would have to cooperate with an organization providing managed health care services. Number three, they could not bring legal action against an organization with a managed care contract for reimbursement greater than that specified in ORS 414743. That is one of the contentious issues that's going on here in Salem. The law is pretty clear about what a fair and contract is for hospital services, and it would just disallow either a hospital or anybody else who's subject to that law from getting up and saying, well, we understand what the prescribed rate is, but we're going to sue you if you don't pay us more than that. Four would be to refuse to deliver health care services, and five would be acts or refuses to act in a manner that puts the CCO at risk. One of the other parts I didn't like about the current language was that it put the Oregon Health Authority in the position of being an adjudicator and a prosecutor. I don't think that's where the OHA belongs. They are an administrator of the program. So I suggest that it be moved to the Attorney General, who is the one that really brings legal action to enforce the state laws. And then that occurs under the administrative laws of the state of Oregon and those procedures. So that way you can get a fairly quick adjudication. You don't have to go through all of the problems that arbitration or a lawsuit brings. And then were the sanctions, and there's some five should be 5A and 5B. An essential health care entity who is in violation of this act will be reimbursed for its services, shall not be reimbursed at a rate greater than 58% of Medicare or the existing Medicaid rate, whichever is the lesser, for 1 year. So made that much more clear in terms of how long it goes on and how it's administered. And then 5B, which is labeled here as 6, is an essential health care entity found in violation shall not be allowed to create or participate in the governance of any organization with a healthcare, managed health care contract for 5 years. So that is my suggestion for, as I would call it, tightening up the law for your
okay, thank you very much for your testimony, all three of you. Any questions? Representative Kemmer.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Hetherington, for your suggestions. These do seem a lot clearer and cleaner, both. Appreciate that.
Anything else for this panel?
Just comment.
Yes.
Regarding the amendments, my organization, WVP Health Authority, actually was in support of those. I just didn't know if that matters, but we thought that was a good clarification as well.
That's helpful to know. Thank you.
Very good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from the other side. Pat Curran, John Hummel, and Patty O'Sullivan, please.
Your grounds for doing this thing.
Yes, they want me to go. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems this afternoon. And we're here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3309. I have a letter, and I believe you've all been given the letter, that in opposition to 3309, signed by at least six CCOs, AARP, Mental Health Programs, GOBI, ODS, OSPRIG, Oregon Primary Care Association, the Oregon Law Center, the Residential Providers Association, Pacific Source, and a number of other people, including the hospitals. I wanted to bring that to your attention because everybody isn't going to come here and testify, and I am representing those that aren't testifying that are on this letter. One of the things that just happened earlier in the session is you passed Senate Bill 586. Senate Bill 586 included two elements. One was the continuation of the ADR, the Alternative Dispute Resolution process, and the continuation of the non-par rate. That's the non-participating in a contract rate of 64%. The first thing I'd like to bring to your attention is this bill basically just sort of undoes what you just passed, because it sets up a whole different process and then sets that if you are kicked off the board and not participating with the contract, it sets it at 58% instead of 64%. So I wanted to bring that to your attention. I also wanted to mention that there are already ways to remove board members. The contracts that CCOs sign with OHA and with CCOs with the providers have language in them about board members and removing board members. There's also ORS 65.324 to 331, which talks about the three ways you can get rid of members off of any nonprofit board or for-profit board. You can do that in three ways. You can do it by a vote of the board. You can do it in court. And you can do it, hang on, forgot the third way, I'm sorry. You can amend your organic documents, i.e. your contract, to facilitate a way that you would kick people off. So in that way, this bill is absolutely not even needed. You know, it was interesting that Representative Freeman brought up the name of the bill. For a while was the Bad Actor Bill, and we decided it was really the Agree or Leave Bill. But he talked about it in terms of a divorce, and I thought about that for a while, and I thought, you know, it is sort of like a really bad divorce in that one player is holding the purse, one player is holding all the power, and the other player or partner in a divorce has to keep the kids and gets very little money and not enough money to keep up the house and the kids. And they have to, they still have to do all their duties for that other player. And that's what this bill does. It says you're gone, you're off our board, and it doesn't take into consideration a lot of things. One of the things is, what if that's just not a nice person? And they're representing an entity, that's true. But this entity is now punished for 5 years, which means they take 58% reimbursement, which isn't enough to pay the bills. And you have to do that for 5 years, regardless of whether you get new leadership, regardless of whether you reconstruct whatever that entity is. And let's be clear here, we're not just talking about hospitals. This bill talks about counties, mental health providers. It talks about the major players at any CCO table. It could even be the IPA, the Independent Physicians Association, if they're not doing something that the rest of the board members like. We all know what this bill is really geared towards, but it's a broad brush approach to a problem A that already has solutions, and B, to a problem that is very local here, and you can tell that most of the proponents of the bill were local. So I wanted to go over a couple of things in the bill and to just kind of remind you where we are with CCOs. I mean, we agree. We've all been partners in CCOs. They're not always going to work right, and you're right. There is a court action right now, and we're all assuming that the court action will tell us who is the good and the bad actors in or players in whatever's going on in court. The bill 3309 has the whole front part about how you kick somebody off, but it also contains pages of things you've already passed and that were in 3650 and amended by Senate Bill 1580 last session. And if you look at page 3, it tells who should be on a board. In order to be a CCO, you have to have certain people on your board. And if you look at page 3 on lines 32, 34, right around that area, it tells you everybody that has to be on the board. Yet, the beginning of the bill says you can kick them off. So in one place, in order to be a CCO, you have to have representatives representing the major components of the healthcare system. Everybody's talked about hospitals, so let's just take that. That is a major component of a healthcare system. And yet, the beginning of the bill says, well, you can kick them off the board. So now they're not complying with this law because they don't have the major component on their board. They just kicked them off. If you keep going on page 4, at the bottom of page 4 is current language, current statute, that talks about if you unreasonably refuse to contract with a CCO. You can't unreasonably refuse. Well, how do we know what's unreasonably? That's all set out here in statute and then by administrative rules that took months for people to agree on. But it also says that a healthcare entity, which is anybody, not just hospitals, may refuse to contract with a coordinated care organization if the reimbursement established for a service provided by the entity under the contract is below the reasonable cost to the entity for providing the care. Yet what this bill says is too bad, so sad. If you don't play, even if you can't pay your bills with what's offered you, we're going to kick you off the board. And then you're going to get even less or the amount that we are offering you. So the whole idea of the beginning of 3309 just sort of, in some cases, it flies in the face of what you've already developed, and you've developed an ADR process. There's ways to kick corporate members off boards, but once you kick them off, that you should then let somebody else back on in their place. 5 years at 58%. 58% of Medicare is actually in the low 40s. Of cost, because Medicare is around 70-72% of cost, then you take 58% of 72%, not of 100%. So you're getting down to in the low 40s, mid 40s percent reimbursement for a service of perhaps saving a life, putting a person back together. EMTALA, of course, tells us we have to take people into the emergency room and assess them. This bill then tells us even if you're not in the CCO and we've kicked you off the board and you have no contract, you have to do it anyway, and you only get 58%. So there's a lot of problems with this bill. In addition, we asked our legal counsel to look at the bill, and he brought up, and our legal counsel is, in this case, is Greg Shamoff, who used to be legislative counsel, as you know, and he brought up two problems that he says we have serious reservations about the constitutionality of two aspects of this bill. The first is we question the constitutionality of the state's authority to compel a healthcare entity to provide services at a rate that may not compensate the healthcare entity for its costs. The second is, second, to the extent that a healthcare entity covered by 3309 has entered into an agreement with a CCO with terms different than those prescribed by 3309, whether for removal of members of the governing body, payment at a certain rate, or duration of the entity's participation in the CCO, HB 3309 may violate the contracts clause of the law. just wanted to point that out. We just got that late today. So with that, I'll answer any questions.
Representative Hoyle had a question.
Yeah, and just a clarification, and thank you for your testimony. And I agree with you that this isn't directed at one organization or one area. There does happen to be an issue in the Willamette Valley, but I think that as we look at all the CCOs, you know, it's not always an easy process, and people have worked through their issues, and I think on the whole have done incredibly well and done tremendous things, and we're going to be a better state because of it. But in your interpretation of the bill, I in reading the bill interpret it quite differently in that. If an organization can't reach a contract, that doesn't automatically lower the reimbursement level. That is only if the governor or the Oregon Health Authority come in and say, look, you've got this, you know, the 64% in place, and we are going to lower it because this particular member of the CCO is refusing to comply with whatever mechanisms are being put forward to ask them to come to the table and figure out how to work out the problem. So there's nothing in this bill that says that the governor of the Oregon Health Authority has to place the sanctions, but these are something that's being put into, with this bill would be put into effect so that there would be some sanctions, so that you can force people to come to the table to engage in dispute resolution that they may not otherwise be encouraged to do so. And in terms of, yes, there is a lawsuit currently pending, it may take years for that lawsuit to get through the courts. And during that time, we're all left in limbo. And so what I want is, I believe what you want and what everybody in this room that's here for this particular bill wants, which is for a good solution to be effected. But sometimes you need different tools in the toolbox. And as I read this bill, I just interpret it differently than you do.
Representative Garrett, Representative Hoyle, the way that I interpret this bill is somewhat like you're saying and somewhat like I'm saying, in that the board can vote, and if it's two-thirds majority, then it goes to the OHA director. It goes to Bruce. And then it says here that Bruce has to use the ADR process that's already in statute that I referred to. And the way that that process works is that a facilitator, negotiator, arbitrator is hired, and they both tell their stories, and the ADR process is specifically identifies one at the end of that process as being unreasonable. That's the way it's set up in both rule and statute right now, because you flip into that process. Once that's done, it really doesn't say what happens, but then it says the director shall use. Now, if it's found that the board member is the one that's unreasonable, I assume paren 3 on line 15 would kick into place. And if a board member is removed, then they cannot be paid, may not reimburse the entity at a rate greater than 58%. So you're right. There's three or four steps that have to happen. So if the ADR process decides that the board members are being unreasonable, then what happens? They don't get kicked off, but they still haven't settled anything. I mean, we understand what you're talking about as well, but I don't believe this is the solution. It punishes an entity for a person for 5 long years. You would get 58%, which could probably put almost any entity we're talking about out of business.
Follow up.
So if I were that entity, then I would ensure that no one person would ever put my entity in jeopardy. I would put pressure on that person to ensure that actions were taken to put everyone in the most financially sound, capable position.
Representative Garrett, Representative Hoyle, of course, that's what everybody wants. That doesn't always happen in life, but it's what everybody wants. And it could be that person is actually right. So, you know, I mean, I've testified on why we don't like this bill and what it contradicts
that.
And what else is there to already take care of this. So
okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Why don't we continue. Mr. Kern.
Yes, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Kern. I'm the CEO of CARE Oregon, and I'm here today to testify against the passage of House Bill 3309. CARE Oregon is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that partners with five coordinated care organizations in Oregon: HealthShare, Jackson Care Connect, Primary Health, Columbia Pacific, and the Amhill CCO. These CCOs serve more than 200,000 Oregonians enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. CARE Oregon also operates a dental care organization, or DCO, in the Portland area, a Medicare Advantage plan serving mainly people on both Medicare and Medicaid, or dually eligible, and we're also the administrative partner for Oregon's Health Co-op. I'm here today to urge you to not support House Bill 3309. HB 3309 is a step in the wrong direction. CCOs are Oregon's opportunity to nurture collaboration between providers and the communities they serve. CCOs throughout the state have physicians, hospitals, counties, community organizations, some of which compete with each other, sitting at the same table to improve the health of their community. Prior to CCO transformation, CARE Oregon was the state's largest Medicaid-managed care organization. Now we partner with CCOs and clinical leaders to develop and implement innovative solutions. The CCOs that CARE Oregon has had the privilege to work with operate both under both the letter and the spirit of healthcare transformation. Diverse voices and transparent operations within the governance structure are encouraged. I'm privileged to serve on five CCO boards throughout the state. I have one vote on each of these boards, regardless of our role in the CCOs. All other board members have that same status, regardless of organizational size or influence. If organizations and board members can be singled out based on legislative action, it would have a chilling effect on CCO boards. I can tell you the conversations we have in those boards are challenging, they're meaningful, they're invigorating. All of them, especially the challenging conversations, are the key to CCOs attaining their goal of sustainable costs, engaged members and communities, and improved outcomes. This is an exciting time for healthcare transformation. We're thrilled to be a part of it. We have an opportunity to improve these models of care if we work together. House Bill 3309 is not that way to improve healthcare or improve the health of OHP members, most importantly. Legislation like this will result in bad policy, bad precedent, and fracture communities rather than bring them together. Mr. Chair, thank you for your time and attention.
John. Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is John Hummel. I'm the State and Federal Policy Director for the Oregon Primary Care Association. OPCA is a nonprofit membership organization comprised of Oregon's 31 community health centers. Our health centers provide care on an annual basis to 330,000 Oregonians who live in rural areas or otherwise are medically underserved. Our patients are primarily uninsured or covered by Medicare or Medicaid. House Bill 3309 is a state bill to resolve a local dispute in Marion and Polk counties. While, from what I can tell, the intention of the supporters of this bill are merely to resolve that unfortunate local CCO spat, the ramifications of this state bill for that local problem could be bad for the health of low-income Oregonians. If a member of the board is removed, then the entity they represent would be penalized through the reduced reimbursement rate of 58% of Medicaid, regardless of provider type. What if the provider is a community health center or another safety net provider? Such a significant reduction in their reimbursement rate could imperil the ability of this provider to continue providing high-quality care to low-income patients. I appreciate that's not the intent of the supporters of the bill. They don't want to put at risk the health of vulnerable Oregonians. With this in mind, I respectfully suggest it is time for this committee to express their strong displeasure with the parties in Marion and Polk counties about how they've handled this dispute, but to then allow the policies and procedures of Willamette Valley Community Health to govern the dispute, with the courts available to step in, which they have, to be the final word. Thank you for your attention and consideration.
Thank you. Before we take questions, I just want to, for those who are waiting, I apologize. We may have had this agenda today may have been a little ambitious. So what we're going to do is we're not going to hear 3513 today. We do have one witness who's traveled some distance to be here, so I'm going to open it for the limited purpose of taking that testimony. That will be the only testimony we take on 3513 today.
We will carry that over to a different day. We will come back and finish House Bill 3510. We have four or five other witnesses on that, and I think we're going to go past five committees, so I'll just hold this open. We'll try and wrap up by maybe a quarter after. We have three more panels on this bill, but for now, we'll take questions for this panel. Representative Kenemer.
Ms. O'Sullivan, have you had a chance to see Mr. Hetherington's suggestions? I guess in this discussion, there's been an awful lot of explaining what's wrong with the bill, and at least here's a proposal about how to make it better.
Rep. Garrett, Rep. Kenemer, no, we've never seen him. We did not get a copy prior to the hearing. And to answer your question, I did point out current statute and current contract language that does already take care of this bill. So that would be our proposal back. So
thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Our next panel is Janet Meyer and Tammy Denny, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janet Meyer, and I serve as the CEO of HealthShare of Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to express our opposition to HB 3309. For the record, HealthShare is a CCO that operates in the Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington County areas of Oregon. We oppose this legislation largely because we believe it is unnecessary. Our bylaws were carefully crafted to have provisions to address exactly the kinds of problems that this bill is attempting to address. We have methods for removing board members, and all other CCOs should have that same standard language in their bylaws. Current state law already provides the ability for the state to remove board members, and this includes all types of business organizations, not just CCOs, in the event of a bad actor. I also believe, and we believe, this bill is bad for CCOs. I think it could discourage providers from serving on our board if it's too much of a threat to their employer or their employment status. This risk of losing the ability to contract with a CCO for 5 years, in some communities this could be devastating. It could certainly shift the balance of care, and I'm not sure where the member or the patient's voice is in this bill, but it could certainly disrupt care relationships, and that would be tragic for this vulnerable population. CCOs were designed to be controlled locally and to reflect their local community. I'm sorry that this Salem market is having some divisive conversations, but that doesn't mean that the rest of us aren't able to work through our differences. Local control starts at the governance level. The bill also changes the nature of board members. When our board members, including Mr. Curran, is one of my board members, when they walk into our boardroom, they represent the best interests of HealthShare. They are individuals. They are not representing their corporate employers. And I think this would really change fundamentally the conversations we're having in our board meeting. We believe the bill invites future litigation. I think that would be more likely to sue the Oregon Health Authority. It could create factions on boards. We don't need that kind of environment in the Medicaid service. And we don't believe that the legislature is the proper venue for resolving private contract disputes. Thank you for your time, and we urge you not to move this bill out of the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Denny. I am here today representing GOBI. GOBI has the distinct privilege of being the mental health and addictions risk-bearing partner in not one, but three CCOs across the state. And one of the three is the largest in the state with 12 rural counties. Ms. O'Sullivan did indicate that Gobi does oppose House Bill 3309. Since I'm here from Pendleton today and wanted to make certain that we put on the record our opposition, just wanted to state for you that I was present and for the record that, yes, in fact, we do oppose. We do believe that these types of governance issues should be taken care of in the bylaws and the governance documents of the entities. And, yes, it is interesting and challenging at times to serve and have three separate and distinct organizations with three separate and distinct partnerships, and those parties at times have very interesting dialogues, but we have to, and we are formed to take care of those issues around those governance tables and making certain that we're behaving as board members do, and that is sometimes we have to agree to disagree, but we don't take our marbles and go home. We're there to serve the population and those who are the most needy among us. So we want to be certain that you know that we're here. We're here for the long haul, and we've been known to be very, very interesting in our approach and how we are willing to say yes and how we're willing to take on the very difficult issues, especially out in the most rural parts of the state. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for coming from Pendleton. Any questions?
Ms. Chair, I'd just like to know what GOBI stands for.
Greater Oregon Behavioral Health Incorporated.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our second to last panel will be Ken Sherman, Lane Shetterly, and Bart McMullen, please.
Oh, there's Lane. Huh? And where he is on this thing.
We're in trouble.
Well, that should answer that question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman. I'm the chairman of the board of Salem Health. Salem Health consists of Salem Hospital, West Valley Hospital over in Dallas, and then we have a medical group called Willamette Health Partners. The Board of Trustees is a group currently of 14 members of our community. These are folks who have long records of community service. They're chosen carefully to represent the whole community, and our role in life really is to represent the interests of the community. We're the only hospital in Salem, so we feel like we have an extra serious responsibility to make sure that we're addressing the health care needs of the entire community. So we welcome this opportunity to comment on House Bill 3309. I want to begin by emphasizing that our board and Salem Health are strongly supportive of the efforts that you and the governor are making to achieve healthcare transformation in Oregon. Listening to all the testimony that's gone before, you could conclude that you have before you a group of people representing an institution that is somehow firmly committed to oppose and to defeat transformation. And frankly, nothing could be further than from the truth. We recognize that transformation of healthcare is absolutely essential to achieve the triple aim that the governor has spoken of, improving access to care, improving the quality of care, improving the patient experience, and reducing the cost. The only way that we can get there is to get out of our silos, somebody used that word a while ago, and work more collaboratively. So we were enthusiastic early supporters of the CCO. We've invested hospital funds along with all of our other partners in creating the CCO. We're proud to take a position on the board of directors, and we still believe, despite the fact that we've had some serious difficulties that all of you have heard about, this is the way of the future, that there's no going back. Ours is not an effort in any way, shape, or form to defeat or to slow down the process to arrive at healthcare transformation. However, House Bill 3309 would have what we believe would be devastating effects on the willingness of providers to participate in the creative and innovative approaches to healthcare that are needed for successful transformation. This bill would throw what I would refer to as a wet blanket over robust conversations that need to occur about how do we get out of our silos, how do we begin to share risk among providers, and to work collaboratively to achieve these goals. The CCO board member under this bill, as we've all heard, could be removed if the member or that member's entity either refused to deliver contracted services or put the CCO at risk of being decertified. I suggest to you that's a pretty fuzzy standard. I really cannot give you a clear picture, and I don't think anybody else can, of exactly what that would mean and whether, if at all, it would apply to our organization. But any organization, whether it's a hospital, an IPA, or any other CCO member that has a dissenting voice on a CCO board could be subjected to ejectment from the board under this standard, and that would have devastating consequences, financial, but more important, consequences for the whole community as well as the organization in terms of the availability and access to care. Some have suggested that House Bill 3309 is a poorly disguised effort to force Salem Hospital and perhaps other providers out of their CCOs. And if this legislation becomes law, that could certainly be a consequence. Under the existing law, a hospital that is not a member of its CCO gets paid at 64% of Medicare rates. But under this bill, if a hospital's representative on the CCO board is ejected from the board, that rate, as you know, falls to 58%. Obviously, if it appears that there is a difficulty in any CCO, whether you're talking about a hospital or an IPA or any other provider, and it looks like that might be even a remote possibility, it would be financial irresponsibility for that organization to not think very carefully about getting out of the CCO to avoid that additional 6% drop in the rate. One of the things that's been really interesting to me as I've listened to the testimony, there's been a lot of talk about bad actors and divorces and so forth, but somehow the sponsors of this legislation have divined that Salem Hospital is the bad actor in all of this. I've served for the last 2 years as the chair of this board. I spend about 40 hours of my time on an uncompensated basis doing the work of the board, and I've never spoken with either of those sponsors. I've never had anybody explain to me or even attempt to explain to me what's the bad action and how has it been discerned by anyone that this organization, which is 120 years old in our community and which has served unbrokenly as a nonprofit community hospital, is somehow the bad actor in all of this. I don't understand that. Here with me today are two of our other board members, Lane Shetterly, who is a former member of this body and who has served for the better part of 10 years now on our board, and Bart McMullen, who is a newer member of our board, but comes to us with a wealth of experience as the former head of Regents. And they're going to share their concerns about this bill. I think, Link, you're going to lead off.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, as Ken said, sitting here today in my capacity as a member of the Board of Trustees of Salem Health and being compensated exactly 0% of the Medicare rate for my time before you this afternoon. just for the record. I wanted to depart a little bit from my prepared testimony because you've heard a lot, and I want to try and speed this along just a little bit. You've heard the bill called several things, the bad actor bill, the vote 'em off the island bill. What I would suggest to you is that what this bill is in very real form is an anti-whistleblower bill. It assumes that a dissenter is the one who is causing the disruption. Assumes it because they're the one vote, because they're the minority. And it places that dissenter then, that dissenting voice, at risk of the majority declaring that that dissenter is being disruptive and therefore voting them off the island. Now, if we're using survivor as our model for healthcare reform, And that just shocks me. We are, as a rule, protective of dissenters, protective of whistleblowers, because we know that sometimes it's that lone voice that really calls the shots, that brings speaks truth to power. And we protect that. In no other situation do I know of where we would say, in an employment situation, if you've got an employee who complains about a violation of this, that, or the other, that we're going to direct that you fire that employee and get them off your team because you've determined that they're being disruptive. I do understand that the board has to go through the process of the health authority to have that ADR and confirmed, but the very threat of that is so real and so powerful given the economics of what is involved in healthcare and healthcare reform. I think that to characterize this as the anti-whistleblower bill is a true characterization of it, and really casts it, I think, in an appropriate light to consider. Sometimes you need to have that dissenting voice, and it is not always the dissenting voice, that is the disruptive voice. The last thing I would Representative Berger, you asked if this, one of the earlier witnesses, whether this was about the state or about Salem. I would say, I would concur with what you've heard from the earlier witnesses, that if it's really a statewide issue, it's not needed. You've got plenty of legislation already addressed at how you work out issues between members of directors of various types of organizations, and each CCO has its own organizational documents. And I would say that if it is about Salem, then it puts you in the very unenviable position, ladies and gentlemen, of the jury, of deciding the case before you've heard the evidence. Because there is a case brought that somebody must be bad, we think it must be you, and therefore these are the consequences we're going to impose. There is a huge degree of factual and legal complexity involved in what is going on in this. You can imagine that. You have been dealing with health care reform yourselves for the past couple of years, several years. I urge you not to step precipitously into that and assume the role of judge or jury and make a determination on a local issue. We've heard before that we wish that this case had been brought through alternative dispute resolution, and I understand that. As a lawyer, I support alternative dispute resolution. I will tell you that having brought it in a court of law, one thing we are assured of is that there will be a public airing of the issues and a public determination. There's risk on both sides of that. We bear that risk. But I think that given what's involved in the public funds that support health care reform, the CCOs and the public functions that they perform, I think it's appropriate that this be resolved in the light of day with a full airing of all the facts and the law.
My name is Bart McMullen. I'm a physician. Internal medicine was my specialty. I sat on the governor's transformation committee a little over 3 years ago. And I think myself and others knew there would be questions that were not resolvable, and I think the structure we set up allowed for that. I never thought I would be here today, however, but this is one of those things that we collectively simply have to work through in the community's best interest. For healthcare transformation to be truly successful, there has to be fairness, equity, and transparency for it to work. All CCO members need to be treated fairly. CCOs need to ensure that its primary loyalty is to the community as a whole rather than to any particular provider or group of providers. All players need to share in the risk. Let me say that again. All players need to share in the risk. Care provided through the CCOs needs to move to a shared risk model, not a fee-for-service, where the goal is really improving the patient's health, their experience of care, how they feel about the care, and reducing costs instead of the old model of just paying people to do things, whether or not those things are appropriate. All providers should equitably share both risk and reward for changing the current system rather than supporting the status quo. Transparency is the key. I would submit that it's a building block to build trust, fairness, and equity. In order for the vision of the CCOs to be realized, its board members must have access to the information that they need to carry out their fiduciary and statutory responsibilities. HB 3309 is a bad bill and needs to be defeated. Thank you.
Have any of you had a chance to consider the amendment that Mr. Hetherington brought us today?
It wasn't shared with us.
I'll just offer a comment that I understand the concerns about
intruding into organizational governance and bylaws and all that that the original bill reflects. But I think it's also, it'd be a mistake to think the public doesn't have an enormous interest in this issue. This is not just a typical contract dispute. It's not something we can just afford to let the legal system play out necessarily. So I'm interested in this amendment, and I would be interested in your reactions too, if you have a chance to review it. Other questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I echo that. I mean, the government, the taxpayers, like or not, are into health care up to their hairline by this point. So the public really does have a direct interest in whatever is occurring here. And so I do gather, it sounds like of the legislative, the members, the proponents of this bill, it doesn't sound like you've been contacted by them. But from where we sit, it sounds like there's a problem. I mean, there's been a lineup of people in here that have said there's a problem. So, I mean, it's stuff for us to process. But I guess my ultimate question, I mean, is there a problem? If so, what is it and how can it be fixed? Why is there a problem?
Chairman, Representative Hicks, I think there's certainly are problems with CCOs. They're probably not limited to ours, although I can only speak to ours. As someone earlier, several someone said, creating something brand new like this takes a lot of work. It's tough work, and there's going to be some give and take. We have felt for some time that the key to our problem really has to do with the governance model. And that we have not yet found, and I again don't know about others, but I don't think here in Salem we've found the right governance model to address these issues from the perspective of the public interest. This can't be an organization that is dominated by any one provider or group of providers. It really needs to be something that has the larger public interest in mind. And I don't feel personally that we've achieved that yet. So that's the hard work that has to be done, and it goes well beyond this immediate contract dispute, which is really backward-looking in a historical relationship. What we really need to focus on is where do we go from here? How do we build the kind of collaborative relationship and what kind of governance structure do we need to achieve what Bart referred to, transparency and fairness and equity among all the players?
Representative Denbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So as I remember, one of the topics of debate and controversy when the CCOs were first created was who should sit on the CCO board. And there was, a school of thought that it would be better not to have people from the provider community, that the board should be just ordinary citizens with perhaps some technical advice, some advisory committee from people in the industry. It sounds to me that, that what we're seeing today is perhaps the negative consequences of the route that we took. And I'm just wondering, we heard that, the goal of the CCOs is that a person who's on the CCO board has a fiduciary responsibility to the board. It doesn't, not representing the entity to which they are, with which they're affiliated, and therefore that entity shouldn't be held responsible for any action that they take. But how realistic is that, in fact? I mean, if you're on the board, are you not identified with Salem Health?
Well, I might answer that question to the extent I can. I think Janet Meyer spoke clearly when she talked about health share, that they expect members of the board to come in and act as members of the board of an organization, not their constituency. That's hard. It's hard if you're in the business, so to speak. I've been involved in those kinds of activities for far longer than I'd like to remember. Sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with the structure that's set up. However, that means there's going to be a lot of work for it to evolve into the kind of community-oriented organization that we all thought these things would be when we set it up. I don't think it's impossible. I think it requires everyone to act differently than sometimes they have historically.
Mr. Chair, Representative Embro, there is a tension. I'll just open the window a little bit to a particular issue involved in what's happening locally, the CCO board is not being provided with copies of contracts that it's being asked to approve. And our representatives on the board have taken the position that if we're being asked to vote and approve a contract, we should see the contract so that we know what we are approving. And at this point, the executives of the CCO board have declined to make those contracts available. And so our position in those is that we won't vote on those contracts because we have a fiduciary responsibility to the CCO. And how can we carry that fiduciary responsibility out if we don't know what the contracts are that the CCO is letting to various providers? So there is a tension there. And they've taken the position that it's an antitrust issue. We've taken the position that the antitrust protection was built into the legislation last session. That's one of those issues that will get resolved at some point. But that's one of the tensions right now where you have a provider, in this case, the Salem Health, wanting to fulfill its fiduciary obligation by knowing what it's voting to approve, but not being allowed to see the documents that it's being asked to vote in favor of and what comes from that. So you know, it's just a flavor of the question you asked and how it affects the real work of the CCO.
I'm just feeling a little skeptical today. Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much
thank you.
For being here, gentlemen. Final panel, Robin Henderson, Marion Blankenship, and Doug Barber. And then committee, we have a little bit of work left to do, so stay comfortable.
Chair Representative Garrick, Vice Chair Representative Hicks, and members of House Rules. For the record, my name is Dr. Robin Henderson, and I am the Executive Director of the Central Oregon Health Council, which is the governance entity for the Coordinated Care Organization in Central Oregon. And I'm here with you today to talk about our concerns about House Bill 3309 and to register our hope that you will not move this bill forward and that you will find another way to resolve some of these differences. We have a number of concerns. As some of you know from Central Oregon, we have been around as a governance entity working these things out for more than 3 years. We have a joint management agreement with our friends at Pacific Source Health Plans, who are the actual legal coordinated care organization, but the makeup of our board, which includes hospital CEOs, the senior vice president of Pacific Source Health Plans, CEOs of many of the major medical groups in Central Oregon, 3 county commissioners, including Commissioner Tammy Bainey back there in the back of the room, who is chair of the Central Oregon Health Council, along with 2 consumer members, citizen representatives in our community, and a psychiatrist. They are the governance entity that oversees the CCO in our region, and in our bylaws, we have several areas that address the things that you're addressing legislatively. But here specifically our concerns about this bill. Oregon's healthcare transformation effort centers around CCOs and their ability to organize and operate under local control. Our CCO governance structure looks unlike most around the state, and that's part of local control. This naturally means that not all CCOs look the same, but it also permits a lot of flexibility to adapt to the needs and dynamics that are particular to each community. And that's a very important point. We all have issues within our communities that, quite frankly, I don't know if it's the legislator's place to resolve. House Bill 3309 overrides any locally developed CCO governance structure and dispute resolution process and imposes a punitive statutory system that should not be necessary. Part of the growing pains of the CCO experiment must involve finding out what kind of challenges CCOs will face. Patience is critical to allow CCOs to mature and evolve, to allow CCOs to deal with their own problems as those problems arise. With one exception, and that exception being our CCO in Central Oregon, Oregon CCOs have been in existence for less than a year. Legislative intervention of this magnitude is premature at best at this point. Furthermore, the legislature has moved a dispute resolution process that's already been discussed for CCOs this session and clarified the non-par rates apply when a CCO is unable to negotiate a contract. House Bill 3309 basically overrides this law, a rational backstop that would help with these types of bumps in the road. One of our other questions that we have is what happens if you're one of those entities who had to put money in to form a CCO? Many hospitals, many insurance companies, a lot of folks around the state had to put significant buy-in to bring up their CCOs. When someone's voted off, does that mean that money comes back to them? Does that destabilize the risk pool? How does that piece work? And that was something we didn't see discussed. But ultimately, we wonder why the legislation is being asked to intervene in CCO board disputes at all. CCOs are highly sophisticated business organizations with highly qualified legal counsel to advise them. Our legal counsel is one of your own, Representative Jason Conger. He's helped us through several different types of resolutions of agreements and helped us establish ways of operating that we are very grateful for. So it seems incredible that CCOs would be unable to anticipate and deal with potentially difficult board relationships in their own governance documents. I need to change hats for a minute because I'm also the Director of Government Affairs for St. Charles Health System, and my CEO, Jim Deagle, could not be here today. Jim has been an ardent supporter of the CCO organization since we started our own experiment in 2009, but he has asked me to convey this message to you. House Bill 3309 is a capricious bill that undermines the very fabric of the trusting relationships needed for local healthcare transformation. Should this legislation pass, the ramifications of the potential removal of an entity such as St. Charles from the board with the significant rate cut would cause St. Charles to resign from the CCO in order to ensure their ability to continue to provide services to the most vulnerable populations we serve. We cannot afford to treat the threat of a rate cut of this permanence and magnitude to endanger our local community. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, Vice Chairs Hicks and Hoyle, members of the committee. Thank you so much for a long afternoon of hearing our concerns. For the record, my name is Marion Blankenship. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Pacific Source Health Plans. Pacific Source is a Oregon-based nonprofit health plan, and as part of our family of companies, we serve commercial, Medicare, and Medicaid families. And so Pacific Source Community Solutions is the contracted CCO entity that covers two regions in the state, actually Central Oregon Health Council, or Central Oregon and the Columbia Gorge area. And we'll get to the health council shortly. We're here to echo the concerns that you've heard from others. We see this as we question whether it really does fulfill the spirit and the intent of the original legislation in terms of really sort of community level decision making, as expressed through governance, absolutely. And also whether it is an overly blunt instrument. But you've heard a lot of testimony about that. And so what I would like to draw your attention to is one particular issue that may be seen as somewhat technical, but is actually very significant and of great concern to Pacific Source, and that is page 3, line 30, we're looking at essentially section 3, sub 2O, and that is where the language changes, it's revised from governance structure to board of directors. And we believe that it was that governance structure was actually appropriately broad, expressed broadly in the original legislation, recognizing that ultimately there would be different models, governance models that would be developed across the state. And in fact, that's the case for the Pacific Source model. So just to go into a little bit of specificity, so Pacific Source Community Solutions is the single contracted CCO entity in the Gorge region, also in Central Oregon. And we essentially entered a joint management agreement with the Central Oregon Health Council and also the Columbia Gorge Health Council to basically perform the functions of the governance structure. So those councils, they are community level health councils that perform the governance functions and essentially the oversight that they have as written into the JMA is quite vast. But nonetheless, the health council model, it's not a corporation. And as such, it is not the board of directors. That function is held by Pacific Source Community Solutions. And so this language change is of fairly significant concern to us. We have talked with legislative council about this and so have registered that. But it's definitely, this was a model that was developed by and for the community stakeholders. It was negotiated with the state and ultimately endorsed by the state. And this language change as written could dismantle our CCO efforts in Central Oregon and Gorge. So stepping back again more broadly, so we have concerns about that language Absolutely, and again, more broadly, to the wisdom of what the bill is trying to achieve as a blunt approach to dispute resolution. So thank you.
Thank you. Doug.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Doug Barber. I'm here today on behalf of Peace Health. Peace Health has four hospitals in Lane County. All of them are members of the Trillium CCO. Those of you from Lane County will remember that things have not always been smooth for Peace Health and other healthcare providers in Lane County. It wasn't maybe 20 years ago that we were in a lawsuit with the other hospital in our area. I'm happy to say that that has been resolved. We are working very closely together in the CCO. You know, you don't need legislation to work these things out. And I'm hoping that this is a case where that legislation isn't needed. And early in the hearing, they talked about the goal of this is to try to, you know, attract the right people to the table and to bring them together. I think this bill is going to have the opposite effect. I think this is going to poison relationships between hospitals and CCOs and other providers. And the key, as Representative Holvey mentioned pretty early in the hearing, is the money. It's the penalties. That 58% penalty, I think it would be irresponsible for a representative from any of my clients to stay on a CCO board knowing that that's the penalty and to jeopardize their organization in that relationship. Because think about the worst case scenario. And I know that the discussion has all been about, well, this, it's a disruptive influence kind of scenario. I think the worst case scenario is a scapegoating scenario. When the financial pressure is on a CCO to meet their financial targets, when they've got to cut budgets, and they start pushing contracts that are unreasonable, that are unrealistic for a provider, and a provider says no, and the, you know, no becomes, you know, disruptive, and that provider gets scapegoated by the other members of the board, which is, you know, it's just not that hard to do. So that entity gets kicked off the board, and the penalty is 58% of Medicare for the next 5 years. It's all about the money. I think it would be irresponsible to stay on a CCO board under these terms. It certainly would be my advice to my clients, not just Peace Health. I have other healthcare clients all over the state. And if this passes, my advice to all of them will be get off the CCO board. Participate in the CCO. You can always provide service to the CCO. They're all Medicaid providers. Just don't participate in the board. Okay. I strongly urge you to not move this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I see none. Appreciate your testimony. That's all we have on this bill. Thank you, everyone, for the testimony on this very difficult issue. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3309. And I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3510. We have three witnesses. I'll ask them to come forward. Dustin Brighton, Peter Cohen, and Angela Martin. Thank you, members, for hanging in there. Wait a second for the doors to close. Would you mind closing the door, Representative?
Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee.
Thank you so much for your patience and allowing me to testify at this late hour. My name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Economic Fairness Oregon, or a statewide consumer advocacy organization, testifying in opposition to House Bill 3510. The bill before you today is an effort to get at some very predatory practices in the resale market, and we agree with that intent. We agree with the idea of creating greater transparency for the disclosure of the ticket's face value. We also agree to have greater transparency about whether or not an entity is selling tickets that they perhaps don't even yet possess. However, as drafted, we believe that House Bill 3510 is too broad, and in an effort to get at those bad actors, individual consumers will be swept up and needlessly harmed. Let me provide a couple of examples here. The bill, as drafted, appears to prohibit tickets from being resold unless the ticket has first been released for sale. Now, this is a term that's not defined in the bill. Let me use my personal example. I'm a season ticket holder for Whitebird, and when you purchase your next season, you are allowed to purchase special advanced seating for performances that they know are going to sell out. The venue may or may not eventually release those tickets for sale, but I have the right to purchase that ticket in advance. This bill would take away my ownership of that ticket, so that if I can't go to some fabulous performances that I hope I can make, what is my ability to post that on Craigslist and offer it for sale? Now, let's say it is a ticket that is clearly for sale. Again, we'll go back to my Whitebird example, and I want to resell it on Craigslist. If I'm not an authorized reseller, I am required as just a regular reseller to include some disclosures. As an individual consumer, how am I to know that, number one, I'm supposed to include those disclosures? It's not on the back of my ticket. If you want to resell this, here are the instructions. And if I fail to do this properly, I will be subject to sanctions under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Now, as a consumer protection advocate, I'm often on the side of saying more things should be violations of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but this is certainly one instance where I think it's taken a step too far and, again, would sweep many individual consumers up into a bill that is good in its intent, but just it isn't quite ready for passage. In addition to the testimony I'm offering, you've received testimony from some national consumer groups that we often work in coalition with. Includes Consumer Action, the National Consumers League, and Consumer Federation of America. So with that, I again say thank you and would answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bryden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and invited guests. My name is Dustin Bryden. I'm Director of Government Affairs for StubHub, Inc., which is a wholly owned subsidiary of eBay, Inc. eBay is the world's largest marketplace with over 90 million active users worldwide who buy and sell almost everything from automobiles to video games and everything in between, including live event tickets. Adding to its legacy of improving inefficient markets, eBay purchased StubHub 6 years ago and has grown it into the largest online marketplace for tickets, offering best-in-class consumer protections, including a fan protect guarantee that ensures fans will get into an event or receive 100% of their money back if something goes awry. It should be noted, and I think this is very important, that StubHub is not a ticket broker. The company does not purchase tickets for the purpose of reselling them at a profit. We do not position inventory on our own website. Simply put, we are an internet platform for buyers and sellers of event tickets to conduct their business. However, because current Oregon statute has a broad definition of reseller, our company is also directly affected by this bill. We at eBay and StubHub fundamentally believe that open markets, free of artificial restraints, are the best way to deliver low prices and value to consumers. Whether consumers are unable to obtain tickets to a Taylor Swift concert, for example, because 85% of the tickets are held back for insiders and preferred partners, or whether they have an opportunity to buy a $5 NBA ticket on game day, consumers do depend on open, transparent marketplaces to obtain tickets at market prices or sell those tickets that they cannot use. There's absolutely one critical component, however, for efficient markets to remain efficient and benefit consumers: open transferability. Up until recently, fans have relied on tickets being similar to anything else they might buy if they can't use them. They can sell them or give them away however they want. Until 2008, tickets were issued primarily in one of two forms, either paper stock or electronically, typically in a PDF format. Both types of tickets are easily transferable, whether via email or email services, and whether or not the original purchaser gives them away or sells them online. In the past 3 years or so, and this is why this is particularly relevant, primary ticket companies have been rolling out services that would either outright prohibit the free transferability of tickets, or even more insidious, force consumers to use their services to resell their tickets. The underlying technology that most of the time primary ticketing companies are using to block open transferability is called paperless ticketing. Don't get me wrong, while eBay and StubHub continuously create and embrace new technologies, that's why we exist, we do not support technologies when they are used to block consumers from using competing marketplaces and artificially raise prices to consumers. We do not believe that once a ticket is purchased, it should be non-transferable or only transferable on authorized exchanges. This bill would actually allow just that and thus limit consumers' choices as to where and how to buy or sell their purchased ticket. This also means a negative effect placed upon charities and nonprofits who buy tickets to give away at fundraisers and to those who support their causes. So how does a closed paperless ticket exchange work? I get asked that a lot. Suppose you purchase a paperless ticket to a high-demand concert and can't use that ticket. According to Ticketmaster's website, for example, you must use Ticketmaster's paperless ticket exchange to resell the ticket, and more important, you cannot sell that ticket for below face value. So if you live in a market where the artist performing at the concert isn't very popular and you can no longer use your concert ticket, you might be happy to get $20 for that ticket that was originally $49.50. For however, because the ticket exchange rules are what they are, you're out of luck. Ticketmaster's paperless ticket exchange not only won't let you sell your ticket at market price, but it also prevents you from giving that ticket away or selling it to a colleague or on eBay because paperless tickets are otherwise non-transferable. We at eBay pretty much believe that you have to believe at least two immutable truths to keeping markets open and to require open transferability. One, consumers do have legitimate reasons to resell tickets. And two, competition will lead to innovation and better services at lower prices. So number one, again, need to sell tickets. There's a real need for people to resell tickets, including season ticket holders for professional teams who can't possibly attend all the home games for the Portland Trail Blazers, for example, or those who need to resell tickets to defray the high cost of their purchases. Fans for whom illness or financial reasons prevent them from using concert tickets, which are often sold weeks or months in advance of a show, or fans who simply have a change of plans. We at StubHub have seen figures indicating that upwards of 30% of people cannot attend shows for which they have purchased tickets. And two, to the second point, competition fosters innovation, leads to better services at lower prices. If consumers are forced to use a primary ticketing company, secondary marketplace, they'll be subjected to a lower quality of service, arbitrary price floors, and potentially higher fees resale services. We've seen this with paperless ticket exchange for John Mayer. The consumer unfriendly policies may even make it impossible for fans to resell the tickets at a potentially huge cost to the fan. Is there anything else that you buy that requires resale through the primary distributor? Imagine if you bought a Ford Focus from your local Ford dealership and were forced to resell that car through the same dealership at a price the dealership sets to ensure that you didn't cannibalize any new car sales. That's exactly what primary ticketing companies are now trying to do with their closed paperless ticket exchanges. This bill, House Bill 3510, as well-intentioned as it is, we certainly don't support the use of fraudulent websites or anything that misleads consumers into buying from an exchange on which they think is a venue's original website. But this bill would allow those in the primary market to pick and choose who wins, loses in the secondary marketplace. It would allow ticket issuers to authorize who would be able to resell a ticket and put our business at significant risk and eventual elimination. In addition, the language in the bill can be interpreted to brand a ticket as counterfeit simply because it was resold without the ticket issuer's authorization. So peer-to-peer transferability is at risk. This isn't, in our opinion, very consumer-friendly. For example, Section 2AI states that a person cannot resell a ticket unless a person has demonstrable immediate access to a current printed or electronic inventory that is updated with each admission ticket sale to show the exact number and location of spaces at the venue on the date at the time specified for the entertainment event that remains unsold. The clear intent of this provision is to allow a primary ticketing entity such as Ticketmaster and its clients to extend their monopoly into the resale of tickets and legally forbid consumers from reselling on competing exchanges. For example, real-time example, the California Angels recently announced they allow the resale of their tickets at any time on their own website, but will restrict the printing or downloading of tickets in PDF form until 48 hours before the ball game. This is clearly a tactic to eliminate competition and a consumer's right to resell their ticket on any exchange at any time. If this bill passes in its current form, it could literally jeopardize the jobs of our 150 employees who work in our Portland offices here in Oregon developing mobile software applications for StubHub and eBay. Primary ticketing companies and venues should be restricted from imposing technological barriers that undermine a consumer's right to transfer their tickets and to transfer what they have purchased. So with that being stated, on behalf of the over 630,000 eBay users and 170,000 StubHub users located in Oregon, and in addition to those 150 employees who work in the Portland eBay offices, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, especially when it's so late in the day. Thank you.
Thank you for traveling to appear before us today. We appreciate your testimony. Are there any questions? Representative Embro.
Just quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you understand the problem that this bill is trying to address. Do you have any suggestions for how those could be addressed? I think you've made a good point about the problems with this particular bill, but what would you suggest?
We would be very willing to sit down and talk about ways to address the fraudulent website issue. I think there could be possibly some ways to absolutely go after those who are developing misleading websites without killing competition in the secondary market and treading upon a consumer's right to sell what they have purchased.
Well, I appreciate that. I do think that, based on what I've heard, so like there may be a place we could get to where we could have a consumer protection here that meets some of the problems that the industry has pointed out. Representative Berger?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to point out that I'm sure you were in the room when the proponents of this bill expressly said that they were trying not to prohibit consumer-to-consumer sales. So I would encourage you to try and solve some problems.
Let's not give
this
up yet. Any other questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, does your organization actually purchase tickets?
No, sir, we do not. We are simply an online marketplace, and I can compare it to like eBay, where you buy a lawnmower and you want to resell it. You know, eBay does not buy the lawnmower and then sell it themselves. Same things with tickets. Same thing with tickets and stuff.
Thank you. And one follow-up. I'm just curious of the issues that have been brought forward in this bill, whether your organization has looked at this to figure out whether it's what some of these companies doing is already illegal under our current law.
Many times, I mean, frankly, sir, I haven't reviewed myself the Deceptive Trade Practices Act here in Oregon or what that covers, but yes, a lot of the time, current law will actually cover the use of misleading websites or trademark infringement.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just would commend that we should really look at our current statutes to determine whether what this bill is trying to cover is not already illegal.
Thank you. All right. Thank you both. I think that concludes this bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Just a little bit more to do, folks. Thanks for your patience. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3510. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3513 to hear from one witness who has traveled north to be here today, Ellie Dundee.
Dumdai.
Pardon me. Thank you for waiting.
And Mr. Chairman, the committee House Bill 3513 provides that matters which quorum of governing body may not meet in private for purposes of deciding or deliberating are limited to budget, fiscal, or policy matters, provides that certain communication, fact-gathering activities, or on-site inspections of property or facilities does not constitute governing body deciding on or deliberating towards a decision, extends period which suit may be brought asserting violation of public meeting laws from 60 to 90 days after date of decision becomes public record.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Garrett and Vice Chair Hoyle and Vice Chair Hicks and the rest of the committee. Thank you very much, and thank you for allowing me to testify at this late hour. I appreciate that. As stated, the bill covers the public meetings law as pertains to our local elected officials at the county level, the city level, and school boards.
I need you, could you state your name for the record, please?
This bill is...
No, your name.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yes, thanks.
My name is Ellie Dumdye.
Thank you.
And I reside in Eugene. House Bill 3513 amends Oregon meetings law in order to bring a level of clarity to public bodies around the state, and those public bodies would include county commissioners, city council members, school board members, those smaller governing bodies in our local communities. Members of these governing bodies do not have the privilege of caucusing as state legislators do. As a result, all business done by public bodies in these communities must be done in public. We have run into some unfortunate circumstances on occasion when that has not happened. And so we felt that it was important to address that issue with House Bill 3513. Public officials need clarity to ensure that they can carry out the duties of their office and do so legally. And we wanted to bring, this bill would help bring clarity to that. A notable change in this bill is extending by 30 days the statute of limitations for bringing suit. Some would argue for even more time, but that for some bodies is not practical. I think many of you are aware that a situation arose in Lane County about 3 years ago where some budgetary decisions were made behind closed doors, and the judge in the decision of that case cited that these commissioners were violating the state law. There was some concern among commissioners in small, commissioners in counties that only have three commissioners, where two people talking together would constitute a quorum. The judge was not disallowing these commissioners to speak to each other. They were just saying they cannot make decisions at that time. They can speak to each other. They cannot make decisions except in the public body and in public discussion. And so this bill is to clarify that for these governing bodies. I don't think I need to say anything more about this. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to address
those. Well, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ellie while she's here? Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ellie, it's great to see you today. And thank you for coming to Salem to talk to us here. I have a hard time understanding what this bill does that the current law doesn't already do. I remember very distinctly serving on a school board and going out to dinner at meetings of the School Boards Association, for example, with the other members of the board, and with a school administrator who always put up his hand when the conversation drifted away from children or other topics to school board business so that we didn't violate the current rules. What does this bill add or redefine from the current law? I'm having a hard time thinking about what that might be.
I think we felt that it brings more clarity to the elected bodies because of the limitation of state law in declaring that elected bodies, other than the legislature, must do all of their business in public and in all the decisions in public. And some bodies are concerned about how to do that. They want to talk to each other. They want to discuss these issues. And state law requires it to be done in public, and so we want to clarify that.
Representative Hoyle.
Having brought this bill forward, part of the issue was a need and a desire for clarification among city and county officials after the lawsuit and the judgment, because there was a lot of confusion. And also, when the laws were written, we didn't have email. We didn't have the same kind of electronic communication. So what this seeks to do, there was a work group that Senator Przanski put together with a number of different parties, and what this seeks to do is to clarify so that we can have elected officials know what they can and can't do and update the statute to reflect the reality of how we communicate now.
Any further questions? Representative Hicks.
For anybody who may or may not, unfortunately, my computer's run out of juice, and so I can't look at the language of it. Does this bill, just looking at some notes, does this bill, I guess, newly exempt fact gathering activities or on-site inspections of property or facilities from what would be considered public records disclosures? Does it change that?
I don't.
Ms. Dumbadai was testifying because she traveled such a long way, and we're going to have more testimony on the bill, and we'll be able to answer the specifics.
We have several other people who will be speaking to this bill, and we have the full hearing. Sorry, I didn't mention that before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I wanted to give her a chance to speak while she's here.
If I could, for clarification, I was not aware of B and C being put into the bill, and I thought that through. And I thought when I was a county commissioner back in the 90s, because I've been retired for almost 15 years now. But we would go on fact-gathering activities, but we always went as a total group. There are five commissioners in Lane County. There are five of us, plus the directors of whatever program it was. It's usually Public Works, and we always had Public Works personnel with us, and it was always announced ahead of time. It was a public meeting. If anybody in the public wanted to accompany us, they were to notify the office, and they could go along, and that happened on a few occasions. The same would be true of on-site inspections of property or facilities at a location other than regularly scheduled meeting room of the governing body. And those any time that happened was always announced to the public, and anybody who was interested could accompany us. It was always an open meeting. So I'm not sure why that those were included in there, but that was maybe just for clarification.
Okay, we will have further discussion of this in the near future. Thank you very much for waiting until this hour to speak.
Thank you very much.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3513. Our final brief item of business should be to open a work session on House Bill 2387. Ms. Seiler, remind us where we are here.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, House Bill 2387 was originally heard on February 13th, at which time you did adopt the -1 amendment, which changed the measure and now directs the Oregon Historical Society to raise funds and commission statue of Mark Hatfield to be placed at National Statuary Hall in the United States Capitol, directs the Oregon Historical Society to request Architect of Capitol to seek approval, and for the replacement of the Jason Lee statue with the statue of Mark Hatfield, and directs OHS to provide for return of Jason Lee statue to suitable location in Salem. The measure has a no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact on the -1. In addition, we have posted online pieces of testimony received by your committee staff. Those testimony is from Tom Boltz, Linda Countryman, John Gomez, Susan Haikalia, Warren Kitchen, Donna Pike, Bob Snowden, Janice Snowden, Mimi Stout, Sam and Karen Villalobos, Joanne Wilson, Janice Deisinger, Kim Rowe, and Sarah Everidge.
Thank you, Aaron. We are in work session. Is there any discussion on the bill before us? Representative Berger?
I'll wait for a motion.
Okay. Take a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2387 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We already have the amendment.
We amended it in our last meeting.
Thank you.
Representative Hoyle moves House Bill 2387 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I frankly have been enormously conflicted on this bill. I've gone back and forth and back and forth, and am, like a lot of things, you have to make a policy decision. Jason Lee is the founder of the community of Salem, which I have lived my whole life in, and most of it, and my father before me, and most of my grandmother before me, and is near and dear to my heart as an Oregonian and as a resident of this community. On the other hand, Mark Hatfield went to high school with my parents, would be counted a friend of our families, also a stalwart member of the Salem community, a devout Christian, and associated with Willamette University, as was Jason Lee. So I have two people who I greatly admire, both of which I would like to have in Statuary Hall at our Capitol, but that is not the question before me. So I believe that in supporting this bill, my hope is that if this proceeds, I will be able to bring Jason Lee home to Salem, where he will be given great honor and respect. And so, therefore, with this is what's called an approach conflict. I want both. I can't have both. So I am going to support this bill, partly out of honor for Jason Lee, who is near and dear to my heart also.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Hicks.
So, and I appreciate Mr. Auer's testimony and his position and the position of the proponents on both of these. I, too, support the bill. Just to distill it down to this, so, you know, Mark Hatfield was a combat veteran from Iwo Jima. He charged toward machine gun fire. He was a veteran of Okinawa. He witnessed the aftermath of the Hiroshima bombing. And taking that, he then basically later in his career told Richard Nixon that his position on that particular war was wrong, and he stood alone among the 50 governors. And, you know, when Richard Nixon prior to that was asked who should be his vice president in 1968, Billy Graham said, I have three names, Mark Hatfield, Mark Hatfield, Mark Hatfield. So Mark Hatfield is not only a man of principle, but he was a combat veteran of the World War II. And there are many places where we can see the names of these persons, these Oregonians and other Americans who have risked it all and often given it all. But not many places we can see their faces. And so the Capitol of the United States of America is an appropriate place to put up the face and the name and the record of a man who truly was willing to risk it all on behalf of this nation and this state that he loved. So I do come down in favor of this bill on that basis with great appreciation for your passion for this issue, sir.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too have struggled with this bill going back and forth a lot, and I respect our history, and I truly respect Mark Hatfield's contributions to Oregon. I wonder why our foundation would spend this extra money to actually go to Washington, D.C. and replace this statue when they could honor Mark Hatfield in a great way in the state of Oregon as well, and maybe have money to do other things. And I just recognize that there are a lot of people who do oppose this particular endeavor, and they have made a case and have voiced that in this hearing room and in the legislature, and I respect that minority. I also respect those, and we do have the ability to change the statue in Washington, D.C. That's laid out that if the legislature does it by resolution, that they can petition to have that changed. But I'm going to be a no on this, respecting the will and the importance to some people that Jason Lee should remain in Washington, D.C., and thinking that the foundation could better spend their money recognizing Mark Hatfield here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I see no other discussion on the motion. Why don't we call the roll?
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Denbrough.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
No.
Representative Holby.
No.
Representative Kenmer.
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Chair Garrett?
Aye. Motion carries. The bill's moved to the floor, and Representatives Gilliam and Reed will be the co-carriers. Thank you, everybody, for this is making up for all those Fridays we don't meet. Close the work session on House Bill 2387, and the committee's adjourned.